Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of the Duke Football Coverage Podcast, brought to you as always by Bull City Coordinators. Follow us on our website, bullcitycoordinators.com. Check us out on Twitter at Duke FB Coverage. We're on all the social media sites, and you can find us anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm not going to list out all the social media sites because there's too many of them now, and frankly, I don't understand what they're all for or how to use them. Maybe we'll talk about, you know, Mastodon, Tribal, whatever. Anyway, our next guest, though, very excited about this interview we've got. She covers the ACC and works for WRAL and 99.9 The Fan. You know her from the Panic Room and from her very entertaining Twitter account, where she deals with a lot of wonderful trolls. It's a masterclass in how to handle interesting people. She is a purveyor of all things ACC, and I will go ahead and say one of the more entertaining Twitter follows out there. If you are not following her already, you should. Lauren Brownlow, how are you?
What a nice introduction. I'm doing a little better now. Still dealing with long COVID, but trying to get back where I can and do some things, and that's worked out okay so far.
All right. Well, I'm going to stick with that kind of flow for the interview here, since you brought up long COVID. How long have you been dealing with that for?
I had COVID in early May, and then I would say by the end of May, I was sure that something was wrong. So I would say since at the latest, like Memorial Day weekend, at the absolute latest of when the start was, like Memorial Day weekend is what I would say.
And that was of this year?
Yeah.
Well, that sounds like a barrel of fun. my wife had, as we call it in our house, the OG COVID strain before they could really test for it. And we found out later, I think through the antibody testing, that that's what she had. And it really knocked her out for a long time. And I'm just curious what symptoms you've had that are the most problematic and the worst for you.
Well, really right now, ongoing is fatigue. It's a big issue for me. I can't really do too much most days activity-wise before I get very tired. But early on, I was dealing with a lot of brain fog, which was much more severe than now. So thankfully, like, my mental capacities seem to be back in place. Met with a neurologist recently and tested out well there. So that was good news for me too, because you're never like sure of things, you know, you're never sure that you're back to 100% mentally, but it was nice to get some validation there. And yeah, I had other symptoms as well early on. Like, weirdly, long COVID makes you feel like you're having a heart attack sometimes. Apparently I'm not the only one. Yeah. I end up in the ER. And I wore a heart monitor for a few weeks, and you know, the doctor warned me, like, it's long COVID, so it's probably your body tricking you. He was right, because my heart monitor had no problems. And so I had symptoms like that for a little while, where I would feel like I was having a heart attack for a little bit, and I would just sort of have to get through it, and because I knew it wasn't like anything wrong. So that was scary too, because there were definitely times where I was like, but am I sure? You know, had some GI symptoms that required an endoscopy. Of course, they found nothing wrong there, but had terrible heartburn, among other things. Like, it does a number on you. I think my most random one, the one that surprises people the most, like, if sometimes people are like, are you sure you have long COVID? I'm like, yes. But the reason I know for sure is, like, a couple, 3 or 4 months ago, I started smelling cigarette smoke all the time. And I legit thought, like, someone was standing outside, like, you know, smoking somewhere that I just couldn't see. And then I finally realized, like, I Googled it, like, smelling smoke for no reason. And apparently that's a long COVID. So.
Well, that sounds like fun, maybe. Yeah. Not really. But, you know, it's an experience, right? You get to, you know, you get to talk about it later. And you're like, hey, look at all this crazy stuff where I was hallucinating about having a heart attack, right?
Right. Or whatever it was that long COVID tricked my body into thinking was happening. But yeah, no, I mean, it was crazy. It was a crazy time. And like, It's still a crazy time, really, because of how tired I can get and how unpredictable some of that can be. But, you know, just at a certain point in this process, when you're dealing with this and maybe other stuff in your life, you just kind of have to put your head down and say, I'm just going to keep moving forward. That's all I can do. So
one thing that I do when in my personal injury cases is I prepare my clients sometimes to tell the other side, give yourself a percentage of where you were or where you are today compared to where you were before whatever happened to you that I'm representing you on, like before the car wreck. Are you 67% back to where you were before then, 80%, whatever? If you had to numerically put that, affix a number to it, what would you do?
That's just tricky for me because, like, not every day, but there are still plenty of days where if I walk to, like, if I walk like 5 minutes outside, I'm going to need a rest after that. And so that's my next goal, is to trying to get to a point where I can move around for 5 to 7 minutes in a row and not need, I think the goal that they put me on is not needing more than an hour of rest to recover from that. And I'm still not there yet on a consistent basis. So that's like, I am happy. I was going to say compared to before, I would still say I'm less than half of the way back because I can't do so many things I took for granted. Like even traveling is something that I love to do and I miss it. And I can't even think about taking a trip right now because I can't walk around very much. And, you know, I mean, it's that kind of stuff that's like, it's just a challenge for sure. But and so that's why it's hard for me to kind of rate it. Now, I would say compared to the way I felt at the beginning of long COVID, I'm significantly better. Like I'd say I'm more than 50% back from that feeling. But just overall, like back to my old self, yeah, I mean, I'm less than halfway back for sure.
Well, have you gotten any explanation on why long COVID affects some people, but other people who have COVID don't get long COVID? Have your doctors been able to give you any insight on this? And before you say anything, that's not a HIPAA violation, people. Don't bad HIPAA takes me.
Believe no, me. It's fine. Yeah. No, I don't really know. I mean, some of it is just like there's no factor that would have made me more at risk or less seemingly, but I know that they're studying it all the time. And so like maybe they'll come up with some new things. I mean, I hop in the long COVID Reddit from time to time and see what's working for some people, because at this point, a lot of doctors just kind of tell you like I went to an occupational therapist for a while and I, you know, I don't have to go there anymore, but I'm starting physical therapy in January. Like that's just kind of what the long COVID doctor did too, was send me those places. And it's just, they all just tell me time is what'll take it away. But yeah, I think there's still so much they don't know about it that I guess there's no way of knowing like why I got the bad luck.
Well, have they gotten you towards like a PMR doctor, a physical medicine and rehabilitation doctor? And for those of you who are listening who may not know what that is, that's basically dumbed down a doctor of function. They look more at how we can get people back to their pre-incident injury, whatever you want to say, baseline.
No, but I wonder if physical therapy might send me that way if they feel like they can't help me as much. And I'm glad you mentioned that because it is something I'd like to have in my back pocket when I finally get to the physical therapist, because that's my goal, right? I mean, you know, occupational therapy could only do so much for me. And that was clear early on for both of us, but she did help me a lot, you know, giving me tips about energy budgeting and things like that. But the physical therapy is what I have the most hope for, like getting back to close to 100%. But hopefully if that doesn't work, they can send me to something a little more targeted towards like my actual needs.
Well, let's segue a little bit from long COVID to what this podcast is nominally about, most of the time anyway, is is sports. And I think this is going to be episode 48. You are going to be the second woman who's come on as a guest. And let's just get out in front of it. Woman in sports journalism, easy or easiest job?
It depends on the day, really. It's just,
I mean, those are the two options. So
oh man, that's tough. No, I mean, there are days where it feels easy for sure. But There are plenty of other, like, there are just days in general, right, where I feel like I'm regularly reminded of, like, oh, right, being a woman in this world is very difficult. I don't feel like a few days go by where I don't feel like I get a reminder of that in some form. But no, I mean, I haven't, like, I feel like the people, I've been around so long at this point that I feel like the people who like me and understand what I'm about have kind of stuck around, whereas I don't get as much of, like, the people thinking they have a right to my time just because I'm like some degree of famous or whatever. I know people more famous deal with this more. Like, I don't get anybody in my mentions anymore very often, like telling me what I should or shouldn't say. And if I do, I dismiss them relatively quickly. Or a lot of sexism and stuff. And if I do, it's the same old tired jokes. Like, my thing is just like, get new jokes, you know, like, okay, make you a sandwich, really? Get back in the kitchen. No one wants that, I promise. Nobody wants that. No one wants me in a kitchen.
The lazy material, right?
Yeah, man, like, just at least like make me laugh with your insult. I have enjoyed the few times that's ever happened. None of them come to mind right now, but occasionally I'm like, you know what, that's good, you got me, like, kudos.
Yeah, that's people need to come up with better, you know, insults and, you know, something that makes you say, oh, okay, you put some thought and effort into this, right?
Yeah.
One thing though that I find interesting about it is I'm not sure what typically triggers it, but, you know, for example, you say, wow, NC State maybe isn't living up to their hype. And then you get attacked by that. And then that leads into, you know, the kind of sexist comments that are out there. I always find that's interesting to see that happen when you're in journalism and you're pointing out, hey, State had expectations that they didn't meet this year. And I'm just using State as an example. You know, it's odd.
Oh, that- yeah. No, I had someone hop in my mentions for pointing out that, like, yes, Ryan Finley. I keep calling him that. My God, Ben Finley. I'm so sorry, Ben. I know you are a separate person from your brother, but like when people kept calling Ben Finley a fourth string quarterback, I understand that literally he is a fourth string quarterback, but I did a little eye roll with that. Like, come on, that is no normal team's fourth string quarterback was what I was trying to say. If anything, it's like, it's meant to hype you guys up a little bit. I did get some sexist commentary for that one because people were very mad that I didn't make their win over Carolina look more improbable. And I'm just like, I don't understand what the point is. What? Why?
Well, yeah. And that's the thing. If you want kind of self-reinforcing bubble, go into the subreddit or your little fan community. I don't know why you'd be going to a journalist Twitter account that you don't have to read.
Well, and I'm sure you've noticed this too. Like, there's a lot of that because, you know, I wouldn't say media has shifted towards that, but there are a lot more people. And I think this overall is a good thing, by the way, but there are a lot more people from like fan-friendly sites that cover the teams, right? And so I think it is even heightened expectations of people that genuinely don't have like a rooting interest to be nice to my team. And being nice to my team is saying what I think is fair to say all the time, even if, you know, you have a different opinion.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that about the fan-friendly sites taking over a lot of the journalism. I don't know if I would classify myself as fan friendly in what I do, certainly not the last couple of years. But I think going though to the sites that just say, oh, everything's great or we're fantastic.
Right. And they're different. But I was going to say that too. The fan sites are all different. There are some that are way friendlier to the team than others.
Yeah. But what's the point of that? I mean, what's the point of, I guess, misleading misleading the fan base, but being overtly partisan I don't understand what the point of that would be. You're not really necessarily going to add value to your coverage when you need to add value to the coverage if you're unwilling to be critical or just say, hey, you know, there's been a couple of times this season that Coach Johns didn't call a great game, but you know, that happens over the course of a 12 game season.
Yeah. I mean, I think access is a motivator for some of the sites, get better access to assistant coaches and sources and whatnot inside the program that might let them break a story or two, or just give them inside knowledge into what's actually going on that they can probably share with like their premium subscribers, right? They get more of that type of thing with premier coverage. Look, coaches can be sensitive. I think Mac Brown's unfollowed me now. I don't know if he knew he was following me in the first place, to be honest.
I should be careful here because I'm a Duke partisan, but I don't think he's up on the Twitter, and certainly I don't think he'd get Mastodon.
I mean, from everything I've heard, like the tweets are legit his. Who knows if that's true or not? I mean, I don't know. I know he favorited a tweet of mine one night about something about The Wire, and I was like, Max down with The Wire?
That's solid.
I came to confirm, yes, he has seen it. So I was like, okay, cool. Wow. So that might've really been him if he's watched The Wire at some point. But yeah, no, I mean, but there's stuff like that for sure. Like, I think, you know, when you have to work with a school as much as some fan sites have to, it becomes something where you have to walk a fine line at best, right? You can't take cheap shots, which is probably good for everybody, to be honest. But you probably can't even fire off a great joke about like something happening. You know, you probably have to be careful with that because teams get sensitive and it doesn't take much for them to shut off your access.
You know, it's funny that you say that. And before we get into the ACC season, I do want to say thank you because last year you gave my site a shout out on the Panic Room after I wrote a post saying that it was time for Duke to move on from David Cutcliffe. And then that led to some questions at his press conference. I think you asked it about lack of energy, the comment that I had made. I don't want to say that that was a situation where Coach Cutcliffe was being overly sensitive, but that reminded me of that. Because of your comment about how you can lose access. Not that I even have access. I'm not a credentialed media person. This is just something I do in my spare time. But it is interesting to see that. I guess, though, in what you're doing, that's not as much of a concern for your role and your coverage, though, right?
Not me personally, no. I mean, I would prefer it if the coaches liked me and thought I was fair, obviously. Because, you know, you never want, but I've never held myself back from making a joke unless I thought it was just mean-spirited, you know, like if it's funny, but it's just mean-spirited, like there's no point in doing it. But I just try to like say what I see for the most part. And, you know, I after this long in this business, like I know some people don't believe it or can't accept it or whatever, and I get it. But I know I went to North Carolina. Many of you know that. And I've been reminded of it plenty by both Carolina people, Duke people, State people. Everybody will remind me that I went there. But, you know,
in case you'd forgotten, you may not have known.
Listen, it's fine. I went to college there, but I don't care who wins anymore. I would prefer, and I go hard in the paint during football season on like, I will say what I think about a football team going into the year, but like if the teams start playing well, no one's more excited than me just to get crushed every year. It's a cautious optimism, really, but I like when this area has good things to feel about their football teams instead of just trying to like drag the other football team down in the mud when they inevitably face plant. It's so tiring for me. Like, I don't know. It exhausts me every football season.
Well, it's interesting what you said about how it's better for the North Carolina and the local teams to do well. And this was overall, I think, a pretty good year for the North Carolina teams. I think, and I'm biased, but I think Duke had the best story of the North Carolina teams. Even though Carolina didn't win the ACC championship, they could have had a better story had they not, I guess, backed into the championship and then all the defections that you're seeing through the portal now. But let's talk a little bit about how the ACC season went, and let's start with the North Carolina teams. What was your overall impression of how they did?
I agree. Duke definitely had the best story. And listen, I don't care how easy some of y'all might think the Coastal is. Like, what happened compared to what we saw on the field last year and what we saw on the field this year with Duke. I mean, it's night and day. Everybody can tell. And I think that what Mike Elko has brought to the program has been really important. You want to, like, this is one of those things where you say, like, change the culture, and a lot of people roll their eyes, and I get it. It's been overused and abused over time, but, like, I do feel like that was there, and I do feel like these Duke players really needed a fresh start, and you could see that. It was evident. I think a lot of them had a lot of love in their hearts for David Cutcliffe. I know some of us media folks, myself included at times, did too. Like, I mean, as a person, he's just pleasant to be around, wonderful guy. And obviously he's done great things for Duke football. But at the same time, it was evident it was done. Like, it was just, it had become clear that it was done. And, you know, now you've got Duke winning as many games as they, like, having a reverse of last season, basically, right? If I'm not mistaken, or maybe one more of the reverse, like
one penalty,
one less. Yeah.
One questionable penalty.
Yes. And Duke was close. Like, Duke was close to having even more wins than it did. And so for me, that's definitely the story. And it's the most interesting. I would say Carolina, maybe too, if it doesn't lose to Georgia Tech. I think we talk about them differently. And it just, I think, like, the one thing that stunk about this season from a Carolina football perspective, and I get why, like, they have the recruits, they should always be better than they are. I understand all of that. But, like, they weren't assumed to be doing a lot this year. Like, no one thought they would be that good. And, you know, all in all, I guess, I would think this season is a success for them. But, like you said, like, the way it ended and stuff, I think gave people some bad feelings. And I get why. I do. But overall, I think you see that they have been, you know, a quarterback that's legit. Where the rest of the program goes from here, I don't know. You mentioned the transfer portal. We saw the way their DBs played all year. It wasn't good. I mean, it just wasn't. And a lot of those were high, you know, value prospects that weren't playing well. And they haven't since they got there. And you don't know where the issue stems from, but you know that to have a defensive backfield that's still this bad and seemingly, like, getting worse, weirdly, it's just odd. like, I think that's an issue that they're going to have to solve. Do they have to solve a larger problem? I don't think we can say that yet. But yeah, I mean, look, it was silly to talk about North Carolina having a chance in the playoffs in the first place. I think we all understand that that was never going to happen. But at the same time, like, you know, I would say overall they had a successful season, all things considered. Just that Georgia Tech game does tend to stand out, because I don't know why Georgia Tech has just owned them inexplicably. Duke might have had a similar issue with Georgia Tech in recent years. I feel like, yeah, like, they're terrible against that, like, almost anyone else, but they somehow managed to sneak out a win against, like, you know, teams they shouldn't beat out of nowhere. It's wild. But yeah, like, I think that Carolina overall, like, the season story should be a little more positive. But when you look down the road, like you said, you know, it's kind of tough to do that and feel a whole lot of optimism. And then state's just tough. I mean, it's a tough situation. There's a lot of context that is important when it comes to state season, like, obviously Devin Leary getting hurt. But then you also have to look at the fact that the offense wasn't functional when he was in. And I was happy to see them at some points this season decide to finally play with kind of the reins off of their quarterbacks, whoever they were, and letting them kind of throw downfield and make plays, because it was painful watching their offense for a while. And, you know, some of my point with the Ben Finley, not a fourth stringer comment, was I honestly didn't understand why he wasn't tried at some point earlier. Like, Jack Chambers seems like a great dude, but you literally don't trust him to throw the football. Like, you're not going to win games on a college level anymore like that, unless it's your literal offense, you know, like, unless you're running the triple option, you're not going to win games that way without a quarterback that you trust to throw. And it was almost like they valued playing conservative offensively over, like, trying to win the game. I'm sure they didn't view it that way, but that's how it looks, you know. They put their defense in awful situations, but they had a great defense this year. The defense did play like it. Did they leave some on the table? Sure. You know, did they, and Carolina both, by the way, like, get some lucky breaks along the way? Yeah, sure. But listen, you know, they got some to go against them too. So it all tends to even out. And, you know, I think they should feel overall, I think they should feel good about their season. you know, for the most part. The Boston College loss is horrendous, though. I have no, it's just like, it's one of the, it's the worst loss I think a triangle team took, and it's not close. And so for them to be the ones to do it, I don't love that.
Yeah, and I saw the Boston College Virginia Tech game live, and
what?
Yeah, oh, wait, you gotta go. If you get tickets to go to Virginia Tech, the answer is always yes.
That's true.
That was an ugly game of football, and yeah. Virginia Tech looked like world beaters against Boston College. And you know, I've said that I think Virginia Tech, the way that they lost close games towards the end of the season and then won a close one at the end, they might get better sooner than people think. But
yes,
I also think they weren't so good that they looked like the team that played in the national title in 1999.
Oh, no.
It's they did that against like, yeah. They looked like that against BC. I mean, they looked that good.
And against no one else, really. That's the other part.
Fair.
And I mean, Carolina didn't have any defensive issues in that game and pretty much that game alone. So if that doesn't tell you something, I don't know what to tell you.
Well, speaking of issues, Wake Forest started great, finished not great. Great battle, though, against Duke at the end. Great game. Loved watching it. Wish I'd been there in person. But what are your overall thoughts on Wake? Because I kind of view them as a little bit more of a mixed bag than the other season, the other teams.
I think Wake is still, you could call it benefiting. I would say suffering somewhat too, with a syndrome that I think Duke fans are familiar with in terms of football, which is like small private school, doesn't have a lot of money for, you know, in general, although they do have plenty of money, as does Duke, PS, but whatever.
People don't know that.
Yeah. They had the first practice facility of the Triangle teams. It might've been Duke, but it was one of them. They were the first two though, and that's not a coincidence. Like, I know Wake's football stadium may look like a high school stadium to some people, but at the same time, like they care. There are enough alums there that have a lot of money that care about football. They're not just going to keep Dave Clawson on if they think he's like not a good coach. But I don't know that this year is enough. I don't think this year is enough to tell us that. It's just, I think they suffered with another issue that hit Duke football a lot over the years too. Was injuries and attrition down the stretch. But I do think like the way the media and other people perceive Wake is like, oh, this is so cute, the little guy being good at football, the way they were with Duke, right? There is a tendency to let more go, I think, when it comes to Wake, when it comes to Duke. We saw that, especially if we like your coach, like we did David Cutcliffe, you know, there's more of a tendency to just sort of look at this and say, well, what else can Duke expect? Or what else should Wake expect? Or what have you? And I think that's not fair to what David Cutcliffe wanted to build. It wasn't fair to that. I don't think it's fair for what Dave Clawson is trying to build. I don't think he wants to be viewed that way. I think he would rather be, you know, evaluated in an honest way. And the way that they ended their season was not good. I mean, whether it's injuries, attrition, whatever, I don't know the reason, right? But it just wasn't good enough. And their defense kind of reverted back to the defense we'd seen. We'd seen Wake's defense be good enough at times this season, but it really couldn't do that down the stretch. And, you know, losing to all the locals is never a place you want to be. And especially with them all coming in like quick succession at the end of the year there, it's not like they didn't fight hard during the season. It's not like they weren't impressive. I mean, obviously they played Clemson super close and should have won that game, if we're being honest. But they were equipped to do more. And I think we all understand that. And I think any Wake fans that feel disappointed, I think they have a right to feel that way a little bit.
So a couple of points on what you raised there is with letting things go and not maybe being as strict. For those of you who are listening to this, who haven't listened to the Colby Campbell interview, I would recommend that you go back and listen to that. You'll learn a lot about strength and conditioning issues and culture issues that were present at Duke. And I also think if you don't hold the team to the same standard that you had when you brought the coach in to be good, you're going to create the wrong culture. But I also think you're going to let things slide, and that's going to make excuses, and it can snowball from there. But I also think Wake and Duke have much thinner margins of error.
That's the thing.
Right. Yes. And so to me, it feels like those schools, and you saw it with Duke this year, a much older team that takes time to develop. They play really, really well. And we're real close to 10 wins. But that's not going to happen every year. And it's the same thing with Wake. You have to have that collection of older senior leaders, and you can really have great seasons maybe every third or fourth year.
Yeah. And I think, like, for Wake to be what it has become right now is not the worst thing, which is like a team that nobody really wants to play on a given year, a team that you know is going to be well coached, a team that you know is going to put up points. The tricky slow mesh, you know, that everyone hates, like it's like wizardry. Now, if you want to critique both Sam Hartman and or Dave Clawson for like not managing end of game situation well, okay, I can hear that. But you're right about the margins. They're a lot thinner. Those programs are a lot more developmental programs. I do think transfers can and have helped both programs, because that lets you get guys in that already kind of know what they're doing. But yeah, look, like I agree with you on that. So it's always a balancing act, I think, for me too, where I try to look at it. I'm like, okay, where am I being too harsh and where am I being too like lenient, you know? And I think maybe some of that, like you were talking about culture problems, like some of that maybe even seeped in with David Cutcliffe, with him looking at his situation and thinking like, well, I'm a Duke, this is hard. Who else can do this, you know? And maybe that seeped in for him by the end too.
Well, it's funny you mentioned wizardry. I was thinking about Giselle and the TikTok witches. As the 49ers were just blowing out Tampa Bay today. So maybe he should.
Beautiful.
Maybe Elko and Clawson should reach out to Giselle and just, you know, get some of the whatever it was she was doing.
I wonder if she spared a spell on or did something with Russell Wilson. I feel like he's the other quarterback. Maybe Aaron Rodgers as well threw in some magic there.
Do you think maybe O'Brien had a delayed one for Wilson?
That's pretty delayed, but maybe
he may not be as good at it as Giselle.
Who else would curse Russell Wilson? Future?
Gosh. Well, probably
Russell's
the Panthers.
Falling off fast, though. Oh, yeah. as a Panthers fan, 100%.
Yeah.
Although, you know, I'm not a witch. I don't have witch powers.
That you know of.
Right. But I can tell you of all the, besides Tom Brady, I mean, I know that those are the two quarterbacks I'd witch if I could.
I'm trying to think who else would go after Russell Wilson. O'Brien, I think. Every Panthers fan. And didn't
Mike Glennon has reason to have beef. He doesn't, because Mike's a great guy, but I would not like Russell much personally.
Didn't the Seahawks have some win against the Packers one year on a controversial catch that affected seeding in the playoffs? So maybe Packers fans.
And it was like, was it like simultaneous possession or something? I don't remember, but it was a call that seemed dumb to almost everyone.
And the Seahawks benefited from it. I'm going to try to find it and put a link to that in the post on the site. So we've identified a lot of suspects here that could be going after Russell Wilson, or it could be, from what we heard about the way he behaves during long team flights, it could be stewardesses, airplane personnel,
his teammates. Listen, if you're doing that on a flight where I'm trying to sleep, yeah, I would throw something at you.
I did not have Russell Wilson getting witched on my bingo card for this interview. But
it just came up today in my thought process when I was taking a look at what was going on with him during the Chiefs game and stuff, and how like it was not going well. And it's like, you know, he's actually been playing terribly all year. Like, I know he's not in the best situation, but like he's also looked like garbage.
And here's the thing. I hate to say this because I really dislike what Pete Carroll did at USC and the way he left him holding the bag. I just, it's really hard for me to root for Pete Carroll.
Oh, as a person, absolutely. Yeah, he's terrible, but he's a good coach.
And that's what I was going to say. You see what he's doing with Geno Smith. Maybe Pete Carroll's just a really good coach, which hurts my heart to say that. I feel like I want to punch my own soul after saying that.
I mean, it's just true. You know, you can, like, I mean, there's plenty of dudes out there in coaching in all kinds of sports that, like, I either know are trash or most people know are trash. Doesn't mean they're not good coaches, you know? Like, those things sadly aren't mutually exclusive.
I know, but as a Panthers fan, this is why I have a really hard time doing it. I really, really dislike Pete Carroll. And it's a pure fan reaction. Like, I can't be objective about that. It's just
he also has like a very and again, I'm not saying I advocate punching him. I do not, but like a punchable face. He does. He looks like a guy like that would just go up to people and say the most awful thing and expect to not get punched in the face. But
he has a Mark Zuckerberg face.
Yeah, that's a good comparison. Yeah.
Very punchable. Let's speaking of punchable faces, we'll turn back to the overall ACC football season this year. Not a great season. It was a season you probably want to forget about, although there were some great parts to it. And primarily, I think the reason we want to forget about it is Clemson should have been in the college football playoff, but they weren't because of stubbornness on the part of the head coach, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's mostly true. It's hard for me, though, because like when we saw what we saw out of Cade in other games, to me, it seemed like they were just letting Cade actually give the ball to Will Shipley, which is something they also should have been having DJ do. I watched a lot of their South Carolina game, and the way they were calling that game was baffling to me. I'm like, is this the way you call a game for a quarterback that you want to become more confident? Like, I feel like the throws they were giving him were just very challenging, and I didn't understand it, honestly. I did not get it. I don't think that their offensive coordinator and DJ have ever been a fit. And I think that DJ transferring is the best option for everybody involved. I still think he's a good quarterback and can be a good quarterback, but it's just not going to be on this level. Now, and that's the thing. Like, we could all see, to your point, like, that it wasn't working, you know, like, for whatever reason. Like, it can be the offensive coordinator, it can be DJ, it can be the wide receivers, it can be the O-line, it can be all of those things. And I think it was, to some extent, all of those things, because they don't have great wide receivers that get themselves open and make plays. Like, that's been an issue for them for the last 3 years, really, I would say. But it wasn't working. Whatever was going on the field was not working. Clemson's offense was not good enough, consistently enough. And the fact that Will Shipley got, like, two carries in the second half against South Carolina is almost a fireable offense, really. I just, that was infuriating to me. I was watching, I'm like, hello, why are you having DJ have to hit these like very small targets downfield, you know, when you could just be handing the ball to Will Shipley, who's averaging 10 yards a carry? I don't try to act like I'm better than a coach, but at the same, I'm just like, I make it make sense for me. Like, I can't.
Well, your point about DJ, I think is well taken. I don't think we know what he's capable of because, right. And I think we need to be fair to him. Brennan Armstrong last season, 2021, and before that, really good quarterback.
Yeah, he looked like garbage this year for no reason.
Well Tony Elliott. Reasons. Yeah. Tony Elliott.
I didn't even think about that.
And maybe DJ's problems were Tony Elliott related. And I've said this a couple of times now, and I'll say it again. It feels like Elliott is doing his best Carl Franks impersonation in Charlottesville. Yeah, that's harsh, but it's,
I don't know why he'd take that job. Frankly, that's a segue. So sorry, but I would never have taken that job in a million years under the circumstances he took it under.
Well, and he was only probably going to get, if Armstrong had a really great year, Armstrong goes pro, right?
Right.
So you go from having a real great quarterback to not a great quarterback, and it's going to be hard to reload at UVA.
And then your entire offensive line essentially transfers. Like, it wasn't going to end well for anybody. And they had a lot of guys leave after Bronco left. And it just was never a good situation to go into. There were guys left that loved Bronco. Just, you never want to follow that guy in that situation the way it ended. Like, you just don't. And I don't understand why he took that job. Maybe I'll end up being wrong once he gets his own guys in there. But, like, why make it so hard on yourself?
Well, it's not like he inherited a mess. I mean, UVA...
No, not completely, but...
Right. Yeah. I mean, UVA was doing kind of what UVA had been doing, which was middle of the road, a decent year, not a great year. I mean, that's kind of been what they've been doing for a long time.
And they're fine with you as a coach if you do that. So in that way, I get it, but...
Unless you throw to an offensive lineman.
Right, exactly. But the way Bronco left that team... It just wasn't, all I'll say from what I understand is that it wasn't good. And there were a lot of hard feelings. And a lot of guys that weren't so keen on competing hard for a new guy. So that makes it 10 times worse. And it's like, I don't know why you wouldn't think that could be a factor considering how young Bronco is and how likely we are. I mean, you're already hearing Bronco's name for openings this year.
Is so he going to come?
Yeah, he might. Yeah.
Well, he knows what he's doing.
Listen, and so I all I'm saying is, like, there was a lot that went down there that makes his life even more difficult. But yeah, you're right, though, in that the common denominator for quarterbacks that we've seen regress or maybe not play up to potential would be that offensive coordinator. And, you know, that's not saying it's their fault, but it just doesn't seem to be working. Another thing he has in common with David Cutcliffe is promoting from within, right? Yeah, that's a big one. Dabo promoting from within, offensive coordinators, whoever. Like, and it's, I understand why he values it. I understood why David Cutcliffe valued it. But at some point, you've got to kind of look at the philosophy you've been overall embracing, right, as a program, whether it's offensively, defensively, whatever, and start to say, okay, maybe we need to go a completely different direction at this point. But it just becomes so much about family and loyalty and all these other things. And while that's admirable, like, it's not in today's college football, it's just not realistic.
And it gets, and I know I've said this before, but it gets easier for the other team to figure out.
Yes.
If former players are sitting at home and say, I don't have to watch the game, I can tell you what players are going to call when. The guys who are getting paid a lot of money as the coordinators are also going to figure that out.
Yes.
Yeah. And your point, since I grew up just outside of Clemson, I have a lot of friends who are Clemson fans. They are all over that and they are frustrated. And the loss to South Carolina just set a lot of them over the edge. Not that they're saying get rid of Dabo. Nobody's saying that. But what they are saying is this Clemson way thing is great, but you got to make some changes because other schools are going to catch up with you and figure it out.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, exactly. What you want to do, I think, regardless, is I think you do want to give your internal guys a chance at it. You know them better than anyone. You know what they're capable of. But it's like, if you really sat down and were honest with yourself, would you really say, like, especially if you're a program like Clemson that can afford it, right? If you sat down with yourself and you're like, who's really better, this guy internally or this other OC, this up and coming promising guy who's doing really cool, new, innovative things? That's the thing with Clemson offensively is that they lately haven't done anything really new or innovative. And that used to be kind of a calling card for them offensively. They were on the cutting edge offensively more often than not. And now it just seems like it's all pretty vanilla and predictable.
Right. And I think that kind of vanilla predictableness has led into some not great bowl matchups. I know a lot of people, when they were all announced, complained about it. Before this one, I thought the Louisville-Cincinnati matchup was going to be a really good one. Now it's going to be amazing.
Oh, that's wild. And you know what? Like, kudos to you, Scott Satterfield. I called you a quiet quitter when you lost to Boston College. So, like, for them for him to turn their season around enough so that, like, but him to still have the awareness of, like, oh, no, I still need to get out of here. I think that's good on his part. And he manages to kind of fall at least laterally. Now, they don't have the resources Louisville does. So let's not kid ourselves in that department. But it's certainly a program that's in much better shape and probably an athletic department in a little bit better shape than what he left. Although, like, to me, it's just funny because the rumor with him always was he just wants to get a job in North Carolina again because he misses it. You know, he misses being close to home. It's why he talked to South Carolina, because guess what? That's close to, you know. And so I do think that there's a part of him that is still a little sore. He didn't get that UNC job when it opened. I certainly thought he would at the time. But now he gets a couple more years to really get in there and show people that he's focusing on that program and on that team. I think there were definitely legit doubts about that at times in Louisville. And now I think you can see, if you see him for a few years doing that and having some success at a program that's been really successful lately, like, then I think if you're a North Carolina school and you lose your coach for whatever reason, you probably feel better about bringing him back. But as of right now, I don't think any of the North Carolina schools would call that a coaching hire success at this point. If they got
him. No, not for a guy who hovered around 7 to 8 wins in the eight. Well, and the ACC is a better football conference than people think, and we can talk about that later, but it's not going to be considered a home run or ignite the fan base, really excite them to say, all right, we got Coach Satt. He's our guy.
Their defense was only good his last year. Like, the offense was like capable of a lot, but at times would just go invisible. Yeah, nothing made much sense in his tenure.
Well, let's talk about the other bowl games. Wake and Missouri, I don't think really excites anybody.
Me a little bit, just because, like, how cool for Wake to get an opportunity to beat a bad SEC team, but an SEC team still, like, just, you know, keep that's a game I'd feel somewhat excited about if I were a Wake fan. It's like, well, now we have a chance to get off the schneid here and, like, close the season on a good note. But I don't even know who's playing in it, so I might just be talking out of my, you know what, here. So I don't know if Hartman's playing in it or anybody.
Well, I'm trying not to go back to the witches and his whole rib thing, which I still don't think was real. But you talk about bad SEC teams. Florida State playing Oklahoma in almost any other year would be a fantastic matchup, but it's not this year.
No, but they're the ones who kind of got jobbed, honestly. Like, they had a fantastic end to the year. I think the Georgia Tech loss for North Carolina, like, being the stigma that it is almost like the state loss for Florida State, the NC State loss, I feel like. Mostly because of the way that game ended and them losing to that was the game Devin Leary got hurt and they lost to a quarterback that couldn't complete a pass, you know? I mean, that's not a good look. And they had horrible end of game management in that game. So, but I mean, everything else they did, it was clear how much better and better they got each week. I like Mike Norvell. I know he's had his moments, but overall, in terms of what he's done there and the way, like, they just look much more like a Florida State team than they have since maybe what, 2014? Like, that's the last time I can remember them looking this close to being Florida State, you know?
And were it not for Coach Elko doing just tremendous things at Duke with the strength and conditioning program and all the other guys he brought in, the home run hires that he made on both sides of the ball, Norvell hands down is Coach of the Year this year.
100%.
I mean, it was a tremendous job. And you mentioned that they got jobbed, they got cheated. When Notre Dame joined the ACC, and the ACC became, as a lot of people have said, Notre Dame's booty call for football. I didn't have this saying yet, but if it were around or I were aware of it, I would have said it, which is, it's like the ACC is looking at the Big East and saying, hold my beer. And, like, they did not pay any attention to what happened to that conference. And they're like, come on in, Notre Dame. And I said, when it happened, I said, this is a mistake. It's going to cause problems. You know, it's a terrible idea. Not that anybody back then would have cared what I thought. And that's, you know, who really, nobody should care what I think now, but you're seeing the problem of being Notre Dame's side piece is, yeah. what could have been a really good matchup between Florida State and USC goes to a school that just uses the conference.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. And I mean, at the time it happened, I did say I understood it because ultimately, like, it was a pandemic and they didn't want to upset Notre Dame either to the point that they would never join. I understand those two things, but at the same time, Notre Dame didn't have a choice. We all know that too. They didn't have a choice. Like, they would have either had to like make their own schedule, which no one was going to do during the pandemic, or not play. And so they had all of the leverage in the world and didn't use it. I will say the one thing I've learned through my, like, you know, lengthening life here is that if you ever have leverage, you should use it wisely because you may not ever have it again.
Correct. And when did Notre Dame, and my first concern about Notre Dame was when they started the partnership, and I can't remember when that was. And it to me, it was always a question of when, not if, this was going to be a problem. And, yeah. You know, I mean, what I'm trying to compare this to, like, you know, somebody who takes a date to the prom because there's no other options. And then next year when it comes around, it's like, well, no, I have options now. I'm not going to go to the prom with you again. I mean, I don't really know what the ACC is expecting to happen with Notre Dame. I mean, they're not going to join the ACC in football. If they were, they would have done it by now.
Yeah. I mean, I guess they hold tight to that, whatever that contractual obligation is for Notre Dame to join the ACC if it joins the league. But I'm with you. They have plenty of money. I'm sure they can figure out a way to buy their way out of it if they really want to and join whoever they'd like. Like, and the thing is, I mean, it's easy to understand at the time why they did it, but this grant of rights deal is just, that's why nothing's going to get better in the ACC for a long time. And that's why I don't see anything good in the future for ACC football or basketball or anything really, because I think that they'll all end up getting cannibalized eventually because they're just not going to have enough money to compete. It's going to be such a stark difference, really.
No, I think that you're right. And I think betting on Notre Dame has not been helpful, and we'll just have to see how it plays out. But the rest of the bowl games, I think Duke and UCF is a great matchup. I think Syracuse and Minnesota would be a better matchup were it not for the way that Syracuse backed into the end of the season.
Yeah,
1-5.
That was sad.
But the Orange Bowl should be really good.
Yeah, wait. Clemson and...
Clemson and Tennessee.
Yeah, oh, a lot of orange and a lot of earworm fight songs. That's right. Because I did think that as soon as I saw that matchup, I'm like, oh my God, that stadium is going to be just a sea of orange. And you're going to hear, if you're at that game as like a casual or as a media member, you're going to be hearing both Rocky Top and that the Clemson fight song, you know, the one they spell the name out at the end. Those are going to be haunting your dreams for weeks. I've seen both teams. Obviously, I've been to games that involve both teams at this point in my life. I've never been to Neyland. I've been to Death Valley, but they played Rocky Top, like, I swear to you, at least every like 7 minutes. And I was like, for the love of God, I wanted to tear my own ears out. And that game went to over. It was the Music City Bowl between Carolina and Tennessee. At least it was a famous game. So.
And you just left. You're like, I'm done. I can't hear Rocky Top again.
No, I just went on the field and almost got hit by a ketchup bottle.
Wait, what happened there?
That was like the game where it was like they created a rule against it was like the TJ Yates rule game where like Carolina got some extra time to basically like tie it up in regulation, which like everybody thought was BS or whatever. And so they were like throwing things on the field at the refs at Carolina's bench. Some players were getting hit with stuff like beers, all kinds of stuff. And ketchup bottles, like full ketchup bottles. I was like, are these coming from the luxury suites or they just have these? but that was, yeah, it was wild. It was wild.
You stay wild. Classy, Music City Bowl fans. wonderful. Good times. Well, yeah. Where are you going to get a full ketchup? But unless you just like,
it's gotta be a luxury suite, right?
Right. One would think unless they just attack, but the concessions are closed by then, unless they broke into the concession stands or something.
Or like maybe if they had stuff sitting out, but they would never have like a bottle. They would have just the things you pump onto your sandwich or whatever, the ketchup pump and the
packets.
Believe me, you and me both. I have thought about that a lot since. Like, where did the bottle come from?
Well, it's like in Batman Returns, where everybody in the crowd all of a sudden had vegetables and fruits and everything. You know, where people in Gotham are just walking around with it.
So yeah, maybe, are they just carrying them? Like, yeah, like the farmer's market down the street.
Maybe at the Music City Bowl, when you come in, you get ketchup to throw if you're mad, or you used to.
I gotta tell you, with maybe Carolina's fan base could handle that because they're not usually known for antics like that in football. But Tennessee fans giving them weaponry is not ever a good plan, I don't think.
Well, the Carolina fans wouldn't throw ketchup, right? They'd throw some kind of barbecue sauce.
You would hope so. Yeah, I just don't. I don't know that we obviously, like, no one's immune from that kind of fan behavior. Everybody has people that would do things like that. I just don't know that it would happen in mass as much as it happened with the Vol faithful. And that I've never had that much stuff thrown, certainly at me, but I've never seen that much stuff thrown at a sideline I was on in my life before or since.
Well, you know, baby steps, right? Just
exactly
moving forward.
It was a moment in history. I'm still glad I was there for it. It was probably top five wildest games I ever covered. Two were from that season specifically, but you know, yeah.
Well, maybe okay. So I was going to ask you, why don't people recognize that the ACC football is not a terrible football conference? It's often a very good football conference, and maybe it's because the fans don't throw enough stuff on the sidelines, but
maybe right.
What do you think the real reason is? Do you think it's the lack of an effective ESPN level spokesman? Do you think it's the lack of, I don't know where the commissioner is these days. What are your thoughts?
Yeah. I think all of that contributes some, of course. I assumed naively, I suppose, that ESPN having rights to the ACC would improve the way it's perceived on that network, but we've seen that's not the case. Like, and then, you know, there's speculation, and this will be interesting to track too. There is speculation that now that like Fox has Big Ten rights, like, will we see ESPN cooling it with their Big Ten coverage, both in football and basketball? That remains to be seen, right? But that'll be a big tell for sure of like, okay, they think this is their most valuable property and that's why they're promoting it. The thing is that it's always bugged me about it is like, look, the SEC doesn't need your help. Like, it doesn't. It's why I judged Nick Saban for begging on TV for his team to be in the playoff. I'm like, you're Nick Saban. You are Alabama football. Sir, you are more dignified. You know better. No one's going to forget you in that room. No one's going to be like, oh, you know what? Have we thought of Alabama? Like, no one's going to, like, come on, dude. Like, you don't need to try to make your case. If anything, there were probably multiple people in that room trying to make their case. Like, he didn't need to do that. I thought it was beneath him, but he didn't ask me. But yeah, no, I think it is like a lack of a voice for sure. I think it's also somewhat of the ACC fan like sensibility. A lot of us are not such like, it's not that we're not passionate about our teams, but we don't have the blind passion, right? We're cynical, sarcastic people. We make jokes. Like, we don't take ourselves that seriously. You know what I mean? Whereas SEC folks, I think, have more of a tendency to do that. And maybe some Big Ten fan bases as well. Just that's just me like having memories of my AP top 25 vote over the years. But
I need to be careful when I say this. I don't understand the Big Ten love the last couple of seasons. And the reason that especially I say that is one. Well, right. And the main reason I say that though is I remember we were coming back from our vacation during when the college football playoff was going on, and I'm sitting in an airport for a connecting flight. We're eating dinner and I'm watching Georgia just dismantle Michigan. And I looked at that and I said, Georgia is about twice the size of Michigan at every key position. I mean, you cannot compare these two conferences. And, you know,
although Georgia is a different thing even this year, right? From the rest of its SEC compatriots. When they felt like beating someone by a lot, that is exactly what they did. Like, it was unreal. And I think this year it's legitimately Georgia and everyone else. Like, it's becoming clearer and clearer to me as the season's gone on, especially after what they did in the SEC title game.
Yeah, but Florida State beat LSU to start the season. And that was when Florida State had not developed into what they became by the end of the season. So
the rest of the SEC was not nearly as deep as it is in most years. It just wasn't. Alabama was not the same Alabama we're used to seeing. Now, are they a great team in any other league? Sure. But we're judging them by the Alabama standard a bit, and they weren't up to their usual muster. There were There were plenty of not good teams in the SEC this year, whereas that's not always the case. But like, look at Texas A&M and the way they played. Like, there were just there were plenty of disappointments. There were plenty of like actual trash teams. I mean, I think one of the ACC's issues too is that the SEC only has one Vandy, you know, and the ACC doesn't necessarily. You could argue Boston College is the Vandy now, which is wild to say after like we all saw like 2007 happen and some of their like really good years, but that's the way Boston College football has been trending overall, like to essentially being the Vanderbilt, the laughingstock, like the team you don't want to lose to, because that's not Duke anymore. You know, that's not Wake anymore. But I think in some ways those teams are also still perceived as like a Vanderbilt, even when they're not, you know what I mean? And so essentially the league has multiple small private schools without huge alumni bases that, maybe aren't as vocal and maybe don't do as good a job of filling a stadium up as every other SEC team, you know? And I think that plays a role in it too, really, is that aspect of kind of just the optics maybe of some of the ACC games and seeing, you know, having multiple Vandies, like I said, not necessarily in quality of play, but certainly in institutional size and in institutional priorities.
Well, and your point about Bama, and I think it's hard to put a team that didn't play in the conference championship into the playoffs, but they lost two games by 4 points. One of them went into overtime. It's not like it's not like you look at them and say you're 10-2, you didn't have a good season. It's you're 10-2
no.
And so Bama, I still think is a little bit unique, but.
Oh, well, yeah. Bama at the end of the day and no one else is. So I get it, but. That was like as shaky of a defense as I can recall them seeing. And then they basically were kind of seemingly like a one man show on offense, you know, and it was a great show most of the time, but he couldn't do it all himself.
But I just don't see, I think the ACC would stack up better against the SEC than the Clemson Carolina game, notwithstanding, but better than the Big Ten would.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that for the most part. I also, you know, especially top to bottom, because I forget which Big Ten division it is at this point, but you want to tell me that division that was it Penn State won? You want to tell me that wasn't as bad as the Coastal? Okay, you're going to have to sell me on something else, because it was. And you never heard it mentioned, ever. It was always just the Coastal, the Coastal, the Coastal. But I've made a similar argument. Was the Atlantic better than the Coastal this year, right? Yes, of course it was. We all understand that and we all understand why. But for anybody to make the argument, and this is always an SEC argument that's driven me nuts, that like any random team from the SEC could come into the ACC and win it, that's ridiculous. And I think it's just as ridiculous to assume that any random team from the Atlantic could come to the Coastal and win it. You know what I mean? A team that's not Clemson. Like, could they? Sure. But I don't know that I would say it's a sure thing by any stretch. We all know the power of the Coastal. We've all witnessed it over the years. It's no one is immune to it.
Well, and if you take Clemson out of the Atlantic,
yeah,
the Atlantic is not necessarily throughout the life of the divisions head and shoulders better than the Coastal. And the Coastal... I know there was no dominant team out of the Coastal for that time period, but there were a lot of good teams that came out of there.
Yes, and there usually wasn't a lot of garbage. Like, maybe there'd be one team that, like, went winless in the Coastal or whatever, or, like, winless in ACC play, but it didn't happen very often. It really didn't.
And I think you're right about that. And I don't know how the perception became the reality with ACC football. It's unfortunate. I think it's going to cause some problems. But to stay on the Big Ten issue, if you look at the Big Ten West, Purdue won it at 8-5.
Illinois, by the way, Syracuse. Oh, Purdue. That's who won it, right?
Right.
Syracuse beat Purdue, FYI. Just, you know.
And Duke beat Northwestern.
Yep. Yeah. Oh, Northwestern is so bad.
Yeah, which is hard to fathom, but Nebraska 4-8, Wisconsin 6-6, Minnesota 8-4, Iowa 7-5, Illinois 8-4.
Don't get me started on Iowa.
Well,
we'll go on all night with that.
Speaking of nepotism and promoting from within Iowa,
like a team that is actively trying to be bad at offense on purpose. I've just never seen anything like it.
Complementary football, integrative. I don't know what kind of corporate buzzwords you would use, but integrative, connecting, you know, I don't know.
Like, I hope Dave Doran wasn't watching Iowa football and thinking, yes, let's do that.
speaking of Dave, and that got me thinking about offensive coordinator changes. Phil Longo, your panic room partner, made a point, granted, that Longo's not a perfect offensive coordinator. Because if he was, he'd be a head coach already. So you've got to keep that in mind. But he put up a lot of yards and a lot of points. That
consistently.
That could be a big loss.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. And I'm really curious to see what direction that Mac goes in. I also felt like he and Mac have always had a very interesting relationship, where I feel like Mac has been more tolerant. That might be why Mac unfollowed me, because I pointed that out. Oh, well. He's always like said a lot of nice and forgiving things about the defense. But like, the offense scores every drive but one, and it'll be like, well, you know, we can't have that mistake late. And it's like, I'm sorry, are we watching the same football game? Like, what are you talking about? And I've always, and he, like, I feel like he's called Phil out more for things, whether it's directly or indirectly. And I think that most likely at least contributed to him wanting to take another job, would be my guess. And then I'm sure pay as well maybe had something to do with it. It usually does. I think it could potentially be a very big loss. I've been more on the Phil Longo is really good train than on the Phil Longo is flawed train. I know there are some Ole Miss people who insist that, like, actually Phil's not very good because his goal line offense isn't good. And we saw some of that crop up with Carolina late in the year. But I think being as explosive as Carolina's offense has almost always been under him, it just gives you a chance to win so many more games than you would otherwise. It really does. And I've never been a big proponent of that theory that, like, the offense, like, sabotages the defense either. They had plenty of long drives this year that the defense still played terribly after. I don't know that it would have made that much of a difference. That team needed to prioritize scoring always, and it put a whole lot of pressure on the offense. And Longo, honestly, more often than not, delivered in spite of that.
And his job was to score points and give him a chance to win. And as a Duke fan, I just got to say, you know, his offenses were better than our defenses.
Yeah. No, I mean, and I think he mostly calls really good games. I do agree his goal line offense can at times leave something to be desired, but it is the toughest part of the field to score in generally for everybody. You know, like, look at the quarterback play they've had under him. Yes, some of that is having talented quarterbacks, but some of it, we saw Sam Howell develop so much under him. We saw, we'll hopefully see that from Drake May. It'd be nice to see too. It's you know, he already showed it. Well, maybe not hopefully for your sake, but it's been fun to watch him. I mean, he came in and was clearly a special talent. I was a little skeptical that he would be like this special as he was this year, but he was really good. And their wide receivers have consistently gotten better when long. I mean, maybe that's the wide receiving coach. I'm not trying to take credit, but like, the running backs too. That's what they've been missing though in recent years, if we're being honest, is since they lost, Javonte and Mike Carter, you know, they just haven't had a running game nearly as potent as what it was. And the quarterbacks always needed to be a part of it. You really don't want your quarterback being a part of the run game if you can avoid it.
Right. And to your point though, about the talent, I mean, talent alone won't get you there, as we saw at A&M this year.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, I mean, but that's a point.
I enjoyed watching that.
Well, a lot of Florida State guys probably did too. But talking to a lot of the players from Cutcliffe's greatest teams at Duke, they were all 2 and 3 star guys, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And they were hungry because they felt like they'd been overlooked.
And Duke had to be like, Duke was always so careful with how they selected their guys. And it was so tough because they not only have to find these kind of like diamonds in the rough, right? But they also have to make sure they're academically qualified, that they're the right kind of kids to come to Duke. Like, there's all these boxes they have to check that a lot of, like, I'm not saying that Mac Brown didn't do any careful selecting, but with the 4 and 5 stars you're getting, like, at a certain point, you know, maybe you're valuing star power over, you know, guys that can help your program right now.
Yeah. And that's why I always, when I look at recruiting and who's got the 4 stars or 5 stars, I don't really care about that because I think the majority of the NFL players are 3 stars. So, you know,
it matters, right? It does. Like, Clemson is always going to be that much better than most ACC teams because they recruit at a higher level than anyone. You know, that's part of it. But does it mean that, like, teams are unbeatable? Of course not. You know, that's not to say that they can't be beaten. I'm just saying, like, I think, like, in the totality of it all, it matters. But I think, like, I'm trying to think of a nice way to say this so that no one gets mad at me. Because I don't feel this way about everybody at Carolina that they've gotten of like 4 or 5 star. But at a certain point, if you're getting 4 and 5 star guys, that means the usual suspects that are getting them either didn't want them or didn't prioritize them maybe as much as you did. And so you have to start looking into, like, is there a reason for that? You know, like, could a higher tier school have gotten some of those guys if they really had put their nose down and worked at, I don't know. I don't think that's true of Drake May. I think he saw, you know, Bryce Young coming in and just said, no, I'm not going there. Plus his Carolina connection that was there already. But, like, you know, I think there are plenty of kids that either are or were on that roster that maybe, you know, I think, I don't know exactly how to put it. They certainly didn't perform to their star rating. Let's just put it that way.
Well, the coaches may not, and it's hard for me to say this comment, right? And I don't mean it to it's UNC because I'm not there in the building. So,
right,
you mentioned Clemson. Clemson has always had very good defensive coaches, particularly on the line. So I think that defensively, at least, they do develop their talent very well.
Yeah, and their coaching talent as well. Although I'm not completely sold on their defensive coordinator, but, you know, who knows? I could be wrong.
No, and I think, though, it's his first season there, right?
Right.
So you gotta see. But the defense wasn't the reason necessarily that they didn't go as far as they should have this season.
Yeah.
I do think that there's been a lot of commentary at Carolina or amongst Carolina fans that maybe we're not developing the talent. Maybe we're really good at getting it, but we're not good at doing anything with it. Or we're not as good at doing things with it maybe as we should be.
Yeah, you could argue, like, Phil Longo didn't have that problem. You know, the Carolina offense didn't really have that problem. I don't know that there's like maybe their 5-star freshman running backs didn't play a ton, but I don't think A, they needed to, and B, I think they'll probably come along just fine. You see flashes there with both their talented freshman backs, but like, those guys developed over time, and you're right. Like, we just haven't seen that with every single defensive guy. Like, one of Carolina's best defensive players this year got hurt for the last few games, which I think impacted Carolina a ton, was Noah Taylor, and he transferred in from UVA. You know, Cedric Gray had a great year. I think he really emerged. You can point to some other guys too that had really solid years for Carolina, but it's not many. And I think more often than not, you're looking in the defensive backfield and seeing a guy that had 4 or 5 stars next to his name and seeing a receiver running like wide open past him. And that, I don't know the reason, but it's happening.
Yeah. And, you know, that's a lot more, I think, stuff that goes on within the building that.
Right.
And it's hard to know about. Yeah.
That's why I was like, I'm trying to be nice. I don't know how to say it, but I know that is whatever the reason is. Right. And I don't know what the reason is. but it doesn't seem to be happening. I doubt it's scheme. You know, I think Gene Chizik knows what he's doing, and I think he does a pretty good job generally of adapting to what he has to work with. But, you know, I felt like Carolina's secondary played better when some guys got hurt and were out. And that's not a thing you should think. But it was kind of true-ish. Like, it just, I don't know. It's complicated, right? Because I was always kind of mystified. Because, again, you talk about, like, holding everyone to the same standard. If you see a guy that's not performing and you tell guys that they're not performing, they're going to get benched. Then, you know, if you see a guy that's playing poorly or cost the team with, like, a personal foul or whatever it is, and you don't pull him, what is that saying? Like, what message does that send to everybody else?
Yeah, it's hard to know everything that's going on there.
Right.
Because Mac's such a good media personality. He's able to push a lot of that to the side. And one thing that I've noticed that's interesting with Coach Elko is he's very good at communicating. He's very good at talking. He's very good at engaging the media. And I don't want to say kind of controlling the narrative, which all coaches have to do, but he seems to do it in a very natural way, and not in a kind of dour Bill Belichick type way of doing it.
Right. So,
and I do think, to kind of look at the other side of the coin on this, what we're talking about in regard to maybe some of the development issues that seem to have cropped up at UNC, it sure seems like Coach Elko and his staff, at least for this year, took a lot of guys that the rest of the conference did not think were particularly talented, did not think was pretty good, and showed what they are capable of doing with an older team. I mean, this season really exceeded expectations, and if he can keep it up, I think it's a bright future for the Blue Devils.
No, I agree. I think the biggest question to be answered with Mike, although I think Duke will take it if this is the biggest question, is whether he does well enough that eventually he just gets poached in a few years. But again, I think Duke would still take him leaving Duke football better than he found it.
And I think one of the biggest challenges could be is if his coordinators get poached, which is likely. And since he's a defensive guy, every offensive coordinator that he hires has got to be somebody who can be a head coach. And I think Coach Johns is showing he's got the potential to do that. And so if let's just assume Coach Johns maybe gets a job, maybe not this year, but next year, that next hire is going to be really, really critical.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. And, you know, the nice thing is I think, you know, Nina King's committed to this, and you can see that Duke is like, I don't think they'll be shy about spending if they have to, but yeah, you've got to get the right guy. And look, this is a big knock on defensive coaches, and good on Elko for kind of disproving that for himself in year one. But it's a knock on defensive coaches that they will hire an offensive coordinator that makes them feel comfortable and that doesn't take a ton of risks, that defensive coaches are more apt to do that. And I hope he doesn't fall into that trap. I doubt it, because he didn't, you know, already, but he's got to make sure he hires somebody that's equipped to give Duke a lot of points.
Well, and his hire of Coach Johns, I think, was really smart, because Coach Johns does run the ball a lot, but he also utilizes all parts of the field well and will throw the ball deep and is willing to be aggressive, but he does it in a way that controls the clock so you can rest your defense. But I don't think I think that, to your point, the biggest problem that Coach Elko could have is if he goes to like a 3 yards in a cloud of dust philosophy.
Right. Yeah. I think, like, you know, I don't think Tim Beck on his own is like a bad offensive coordinator necessarily, but I think, and that's another thing too, is defensive coaches can sometimes influence the philosophy of their own offensive coordinator. And I just think that their defense was so good this year that I think Dave Doran felt like it put them in a position that they didn't have to take as many risks, when the reality is your defense may be great, but it can't hold up a whole game against today's like modern college offenses. It just can't. And that's where I think that Dave's like who he is at heart, you know, inside just kind of came back up to the surface a little bit with the way that plays were called. But you know what? Tim Beck moves on. Good for him. And the Anai hire is interesting for them, I feel like. I thought it was, I mean, Syracuse did some good things. I know Virginia fans always had a mixed relationship with him, weirdly enough. I know. It was kind of like the Phil Longo critiques, right? A little bit, where it's like, why do you call this play in that situation? Whatever. But I think Anai has done some cool things as an offensive coordinator. I'd be interested to see what he can do there. But philosophically, I think Dave's just going to have to trust his quarterback and his offense and let them go try and make plays, because you just don't win college football games without scoring points. You just can't. It's hard.
0-0 tie.
Yes. I mean, listen, I'm here for it. That doesn't mean that I think it's going to happen again anytime soon.
I'm just saying, you know, let's go back to Beamer Bowl. We shouldn't knock Beamer Bowl because he was a really successful coach, but that screenshot has haunted the Coastal for a long time.
I love it.
And the conference. Well, you know, it's
the game was art. It was so bad. Like, I'm a big fan of so bad it's good programming sometimes, because you just need to laugh. And that game was so much that, like, sometimes those games are just sad bad. That game was, like, hilarious bad. Trust me. If anyone ever wants to rewatch it, just know. I have a detailed recap of it somewhere on the internet. Because I didn't get to watch it live. I was so sad about that. So I watched it again.
Find that. Email it to me. I will look for it, too. I will look for it too for when I post this, but you have been very kind with your time here on a Sunday evening to talk about the ACC witching Tom Brady and Russell Wilson and the demise of our old friend Coastal Chaos. It's gone now, folks. Pour one out for it. If you listen, you know that I give every guest an open mic to talk about whatever they want to talk about. So right now, the floor is yours.
Oh, gosh. Well, God, I feel like I've already said most things. I will say this is the time of year that your local domestic violence shelter could really use your help. They need all kinds of supplies for mothers. Like, they need baby supplies, all kinds of things like that, extra clothes, whatever it is. So if you have time and the means, I would encourage everyone to donate to your local domestic violence shelter so that they can have as happy of a holiday as possible.
Well, that is a great open mic segment and a great cause. And thank you for mentioning that. That is something that often does get overlooked. Well, it gets overlooked on a larger societal issue, which we could spend hours talking about.
Yes.
So I appreciate you mentioning that. Thank you for coming on. And for everybody who is listening, we've got a few more interviews lined up. Those of you who follow me know with the health issues and the family, it was great to see Dad again this weekend. I've been a little bit distracted, so I had a lot of these interviews planned early, which I'm sticking to. I've kind of fallen off on scheduling the rest of season three, but I'm just going to kind of play it by ear, see how many more of these we can do this season. But Dad's doing great. He's obviously tired, and I appreciate everybody's kind words, prayers, and good vibes and thoughts as he goes through this. And stay tuned. There will be more episodes. They may filter off. They may, you know, titrate down a little bit for a while, but I will get back at it just as soon as I am able to. And so with that, please go check us out at our website, BullCityCoordinators.com. Follow us on Twitter @DukeFBCoverage. And as always, go Duke.